trying to heal, I use that word intentionally, trying to heal my health conditions with food and with nutrition made me sicker. It made me more unhealthy, more stressed, more fixated. It made me orthorexic and really rigid. And if we actually just take a nervous system stress response perspective here, that reality that I had, the stress and the fixation, that's good for absolutely zero. And I can see how this really valid, this really understandable desire that I had to cure my chronic health conditions actually led to the development of my eating disorder and body obsession. And the messages that I could heal or I could cure myself came from so many places, including from health professionals. And this is really profound, so much so that when a health professional treating my ulcerative colitis, which is an inflammatory bowel disease, when that person did not mention my diet or the influence of diet, I was mad. I remember telling friends how I thought that this doctor did me a disservice. Doesn't he know about food? And I guess what's really evident, you know, guess what I was studying? Guess what I was immersed in at the time? I was studying nutrition. I was completely immersed in wellness culture or wellness industry, as you'll hear more about in this episode. I'm Nadia Felsch, nutritionist and intuitive eating counselor. In this podcast, we explore the practical aspects of leaving the diet mentality behind and finding your own food and body freedom. In this episode, I'll be diving into the problem with wellness culture, and I have the utmost privilege and pleasure of being joined in this exploration by certified eating disorder registered dietitian and certified intuitive eating specialist, Anna Sweeney. If you spent any time at all in the anti-diet space here on social media, I don't know why I said here, it's not here, but if you have, you will know Anna well, and you will no doubt be really excited to hear more from her as I was in this episode. So in our exploration of wellness culture, Anna and I cover a lot of ground, a lot of really fascinating ground, including her own journey that was navigating these ideas of wellness that were recommended to her after her diagnosis with multiple sclerosis. That's actually where we kick off our chat. We talk about the real immense power and problem that comes from that power in this idea that food can cure. We talk about some of the concepts and some of the books of, you know, really wellness ideas that we were both caught up in, and really how the role of the individual, the burden that we can feel that we are purely and only responsible for our health and the moralism that can come from that factors in. We also cover the intersection of diet culture with wellness culture, the really problematic and terrifying influence of food as medicine from actual doctors and celebrities that really are very prominent in this wellness space. And Anna delightfully lets me know after recording how I teach her invaluable insights about the Kardashians. Very important. So enjoy our discussion. You might hear a dog barking. Such is home office life. I will be back at the end with a wrap up for you. And as I said, we begin this exploration with Anna sharing how it felt to be suggested that she should limit certain foods after she was diagnosed with MS.
I mean, I was diagnosed with MS when I was 15, and the first recommendation was made to me to limit saturated fat. And so for a short period of time, I experimented with, I think I bought like veggie dogs and tried to veggie dogs in like the early 2000s, I'm sure were different than they are now. And no shame to veggie dog consumers. But that offering from my neurologist was not interesting to me as a child, and I just wanted my life. And so fast forwarding, I am no longer 15. I've had MS. Retrospectively, I've had MS for 24 years now, because I developed MS when I was 12, but I wasn't diagnosed until I was 15. One of the challenging parts of my experience, and I really want to be thoughtful about this because I think it's so important, really important to me, to be acknowledging the layers of my privilege that have really informed my experience as a person with MS. In every single way, I am a privileged human who has been navigating this pretty incredible disease. But part of the privilege that I've had has been that of some financial flexibility to explore with many different kinds of practitioners, not simply my neurologist who was treating me with, you know, immunosuppressive drugs to actually control my disease, but a bunch of auxiliary practitioners over the years to augment and kind of bolster my well-being, as it were. And I remember when gluten-free was becoming like a really popular thing. And this was before Terry Walls published her book about how she, quote, healed herself from multiple sclerosis, which is a misnomer. But I was working in an eating disorder. I was working in a clinic, and I chose to go gluten-free and dairy-free because, you know, I was going to stall my disease progression. And now, certainly, and even then, eating in a gluten-free and dairy-free fashion was pretty easy. I remember 5 or 6 years prior, I had a colleague with celiac disease, and I remember her cutting into a loaf of Kinnikinick frozen gluten-free bread, and it was a brick. You had to use a knife to separate the pieces, and she had celiac disease, and that was like, that was how she was eating bread. And fast forward, I have my first, I had so many people tell me to stop eating gluten and dairy, and it was like practitioners and friends and neighbors, and
was everywhere.
It was just this ubiquitous, like, if you're not doing this, you're not doing all the things that you can do to prevent, you know, disease progression, as it were. So I did it. And then Terry Wall, then I stopped because I still had MS and it was getting in the way of my ability to eat with my clients. So I stopped. And then Terry Walls wrote a book. For the first 2 years that it was out, I ignored it because I just thought it was like ignorant. And I, although my disease was progressing, it wasn't progressing in ways that were making me particularly scared or acutely scared. And then, I don't know, at some point I went from having relapsing remitting MS to having secondary progressive MS. And I don't know like where that dial was turned. No one ever said there has been an evolution of your diagnosis. It's just, you've had this disease for a long time. And as happens for a lot of humans who are not appropriately medicated and in some ways don't have, you know, good luck, whatever, disease progression just happens. So I started falling, Nadia, and like tripping on air. And
that's what you could see, the difference, like the transition.
I started falling. I was less able to do the things that I had been familiar with doing. Like stairs were more challenging than I wanted them to be. And I was having no fun. So I went to my beloved supervision group. We've been together for about a decade now.
Wow. That's cool.
It's amazing. And actually consulted with them. Like, could I be a good eating disorder dietitian and follow this really, really, really rigid rules only way of eating and still be like fiercely anti-diet, fiercely in support of my clients' healing and body autonomy and all of that. And they, of course, were supportive and said, "You do what you need to do, Anna." And the humdinger of it all is it didn't work. It was very expensive. It was very laborious. It made eating like tedious and boring and not intuitive for the first time in my whole life. Right. And I still had MS and I didn't heal myself. Shoot. Mm-hmm. And I felt terribly about that.
As in that, hey, this hadn't worked.
Yeah. There was a lot of like, could I have done this for a little bit longer? Should I have stuck with it? I'm a dietitian. If I can't do this, like all of the stories that I hear all the time. And it's one of the things I think about wellness culture is the wellness industry is disgusting because it's not actually about wellness. And particular pandering to folks who have chronic illnesses. And that's not to say if someone actually has an underlying intolerance to gluten or something like that, and they eliminate a food that makes them feel poorly, that that's not going to improve quality of life and perhaps disease outcome. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And without testing, we shouldn't read books and then just like uniformly follow somebody else's rules. But it's just heartbreaking because it is the industry just is an industry. It wants us coming back.
Yeah. And could we, I guess anyone listening, but could we also acknowledge how attractive, I don't know if that's the best word here, but how enticing, how I think particularly, as you said, like folks who are going to be in a more vulnerable place with a chronic illness, with chronic disease, to think that, hey, I could fix this. I can heal this, I think is the term you used. I see cure touted all the time. And just, yeah, I mean, super, super tempting and believable, would you say as well? Like it all feels really believable.
It feels really believable. And there are people on the planet who are going to say that it worked for them. Mm-hmm. And I mean, everyone wants to have hope. We all want to have belief that we can feel well and be well. And that all of that is within our control.
Yes.
And that's the wellness culture lie, that like the whole, you can stay alive forever, basically, is what wellness culture is saying. But the idea that we have this ability to really control like health status or disease outcomes by virtue of personal choice.
Yeah, the individualism is really at the core. But this, and I feel like you were speaking to that. Let me know if I misunderstood or misheard you, but that way that you felt when, hey, this didn't work. Because I guess it sounds to me like it felt like this should I should have been able to do this.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. And I didn't. So now what? Yeah.
You're right.
So I feel like that in itself, even out of context of dealing with disease progression or any chronic illness that someone might be existing and living with, how disempowering. Like the individualism itself is such a, it's just shit. I don't really know if I have another way to say it.
Just shit.
It's just shit.
That's okay. That's enough. Very eloquent. I agree.
Thank you. So I guess the other thing that's really interesting is when you talk about the folks who I definitely, and you know, you see it online,
I mean, to be honest, I think it's really harmful when you see someone giving that advice to someone else. Like, I mean, that's just like someone shares they have cancer and the next thing there's 400 comments about, hey, have you tried this diet? Please don't anybody ever do that. Even as a professional, right? Like, not okay.
Ever.
No. Ever. And to, I guess what I was thinking in that space is that something working for someone, if it feels as well, like you kind of alluded to before, if that feels like their call, like, hey, I've made this dish. I mean, I've done that. I'm sure we've all done that level of, oh, maybe this doesn't work so well for me. I'm going to tweak it. And I feel this way because of it. That's so cool. I'm thrilled for you. And that doesn't equal writing a book, giving advice. I feel like the practitioners in this space, especially like your wellness gurus, you know, your Hymans of the world, et cetera, this is their bread and butter though.
And they exploit people over and over and over again. And it is profound how powerful this section of like the medical wellness community is, because he put a dot, like put an MD at the end of it. Like, this is why Terry Walls's book sold, right? I'm a doctor. I was in an anti-gravity wheelchair. Now I'm riding a bike. Yeah. And she came to an Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics conference. She keynoted a conference in the States and talked about her 9 cups of different colors of vegetables a day. Right. And like her, the healing. Clinical patient, her, the things that healed her, the very prescriptive orthorexia. And that, the thing that horrified me about that was that there were going to be thousands of dietitians who were sitting in that room.
Like soaking
it and
up.
Everybody knows somebody who has a need. And then because it was at this conference, they're going to say, like, there's a check mark beside this. It says, oh my gosh, I heard this thing at this conference that this woman healed herself of this disease, that there is no heal, like there's no cure for MS. There is not like a get better right now.
Yeah. Deep breaths on that. You know,
that, go ahead.
No, it made me think of, I haven't thought about this for a long time. My grandmother passed away so close with my nanu. She passed away about 8 years ago. Cause of death was dementia. So when she passed away, you know, very peacefully, and we're so lucky that she was where she was and she had a lovely long life, but still hard on everybody, including her, I'm sure. I became obsessed with the medical kind of subcategory of wellness, convinced my mum will never get this. If we do this, I will never get this. And I came across a book called The Grain Brain.
Yep.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, goodness.
My fearful, grief-stricken, really vulnerable brain. I mean, I completely acknowledge I wasn't suffering in that space, but I was deeply concerned for our family and, hey, maybe I can stop this. Maybe I never have to deal with this suffering again. And I remember becoming terrified of not just grains, but like legumes, a whole category of food that I love, absolutely love. And my body loves. And I mean, that lasted for a long time, those lingering, and, you know, sure, this was quite a while ago, but you're so right that you pop that MD or kind of doctor, because that author was a medical doctor, or is a medical doctor. But is that's kind of when you're thinking about this keynote, it sounds like you could feel the bigger impact of hearing that. Yeah.
I wasn't there because the conferences are super inaccessible, but
of
I was just
they are.
I was watching it happen. Like, oh shit, right. This is going to trickle down in a really painful way. And how human of all of us to want to do the things to prevent suffering, to prevent, I mean, my grandmother died with dementia about 7 years ago, mm-hmm. and her mother actually had Alzheimer's, her sisters had Alzheimer's, and like my mom, this is a real thing. Mm-hmm. And my mom lives a completely different life than her mother did and her grandmother did. And it's like the, you know, in the space of grief and also wanting to prevent pain in the future, it just makes sense. And I think that's one of the things about wellness culture that's so dangerous is that there's always going to be an offering for any sort of circumstance. Someone is going to come up with something. Like, I don't know who developed celery juice as something, but who ever decided? Like, celery is a crispy vegetable, but like, who said, I want to drink that, and it's going to do this? It doesn't even make sense.
Well, the spirit said it, didn't they, Anna? Wasn't it the spirit?
I really hope that that's the answer, because if it is, Nadia, that is about as close to anything making sense to explain why anyone would drink the juice of celery.
Yeah.
It had to be a spirit. Okay.
That we've solved that one.
It was the medium. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
You forgot that. Do you think the reason that it is, I guess I want to say normalized, but you know, like what you just said, so we have X problem, someone's identifying, I feel this way, or I have a diagnosis or something's going on. There's this product, there's this service, there's this idea. Do you feel that that really speaks volumes of the enormous intersection with the fact that wellness culture is also partly diet culture? So we accept that very binary view of food. Oh, okay, cool. This is the good stuff. Because all this other stuff I'm having, like all this inflammatory food I'm having, is so bad for me, I must need celery juice, right?
I've actually come, and it is the culture because it is here, but I'm trying to actually like reuse it, to introduce the word industry, because I think that it is so much bigger. Yes. And like, it is a cultural phenomena, but there are these big financial institutions that are here looking to have us come back and back and back and back. Mm-hmm. And then the culture kind of comes out of that and bleeds into everything. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think one of my experiences of being a person with thin privilege in MS is, I mean, I fired a neurologist who asked me to come talk to people who had MS that were in larger bodies, as though body size has anything to do with neurological anything. And mm-hmm. I was at an earlier part of my career where I didn't have, maybe I just didn't want to actually provide her with science and context for why we were no longer seeing one another. But this is just a really hard planet to have a body on. Mm-hmm. And because the diet culture noise is so loud, and because the wellness noise overlapping with diet stuff, we're accustomed to persistent diet chatter. Mm-hmm. And now there's this like layer of morality on top of it that is like prevention and live forever and whatever,
that you're under obligation to pursue that as well. That makes you a better person.
And if you're not playing that game, you are putting your hand up and saying, whatever happens to me is I've absolved myself of responsibility. I don't care about my health. And it's just profoundly unfair. Mm-hmm. Because the project of having this body it's hard enough, and navigating all of this noise that really isn't about any one of us. Mm-hmm. And surely if a human doesn't have access to food, that's a big deal. If we don't have access to water, if we don't have access to good healthcare or social connections and the things that we actually know that impact health outcomes, those are really different things. I think about even intermittent fasting. Mm-hmm. Only people who have prevalent access to food would say, I'm going to choose to not eat for however many hours. It is just maddening, because it's really not designed to elicit healthy relationships with food or body at all. It is all about outsourcing body wisdom all the time.
Yeah. What is the term you used before? I believe it's when you were talking about Terry. Was it sanctified orthorexia, or was that there was a phrase? It was so, because it's the same. It's this playbook, I guess, if you will. I've just been watching an NFL movie, so that's really in my head, this playbook of do this, it will equal this. Outsource all of your wisdom, because that's what you've been told your whole life. And we also have this enormous, I so appreciate your use of the term industry. I also feel that's so much more accurate and calls it what it is, that there is a machine here. There is a complex here. This is not about feeling well or quality of life, or, I mean, really, to your point about food security, plenty of folks don't have enough. So that might be a place we would start if we were truly concerned with health and well-being or basic income, you know, all those kinds of things.
Basic things.
Yeah.
Basic.
Do you think that's why, you know, hand on heart, I've worked really hard to not make this something that I need to be embarrassed about, but I'm going to be honest, there still is a little bit. I love terrible television shows. The ones that are really problematic, the ones that have terrible things to say about bodies and women, just all those. I love all those, right? I'm very conscious of what they are saying and influencing me about. But one of the ones that's really brought a lot of this to light is the kind of, I guess when I watch, I know it's finished now, but the Kardashians, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, the element there of, I see a lot of the piousness that comes out here about one of the sisters. If anyone's not familiar, she's got a whole brand herself in this space of wellness. She talks forever about what her children can or can't eat, what she can or can't eat, but really making it very judgmental about her sisters who don't have those beliefs. Like, oh, look at that junk you're eating, she might say. You know, we're gluten-free. To my knowledge, I might be wrong, but she's not ever declared she's a celiac. So I guess, do you feel like that's another layer of why the celebrity here, the Goops, the Gwyneths, why that's also, we're almost like primed to take it in?
Sure. Sure. And I think that, I mean, you speak to two different things, right? Gwyneth Paltrow is kind of this everlasting creature. It's really interesting to watch her age, because I know she doesn't have Botox. She has some alternative muscle.
Okay, right. Some version.
Thing. Okay. It's just not named Botox, but so we have this celebrity who is, she must be in her 40s, her mid or late 40s. I don't know how old she is. And I will confess, I've actually never seen an episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
Where have you been?
I'm
even more embarrassed now.
No. Okay. So I have one for you.
Okay.
Beginning of the pandemic.
Yes.
Started in quarantine, even though I was working the whole time. I watched, in 2020, I watched every episode of every season from every country that was available of Love Island.
Fascinating.
I went way, I need no brain power. This is disgusting. I'm still watching.
So even the Australian ones, because
I've
never seen them, but I know what it is.
You're not missing anything.
Okay.
But I haven't caught up in the more recent years, but it was a deep dive. I needed to not be in my house.
Absolutely.
But you're completely right. Right. So Gwyneth is this everlasting thing. Mm. And the same thing with like Nicole Kidman, watching her on things now.
Yeah.
Seeing these people age with into different faces. It is a fascinating thing to see. Mm. And then having a younger branded Kim Kardashian, I don't know anything about her. I just know that she had the lollipop, like fiber lollipop.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, it's actually her sister Courtney that has the wellness. Yeah. So Kim is all about, I hate like fat people. I mean, they all hate fat people. Let's be really clear. Yeah. They're incredibly fat phobic. But Courtney, who I believe is the eldest, wow, I'm getting deep here, is very wellness and links it constantly to, I guess, moralism. That I take it that she thinks she's better than her sisters. Whereas the other two just talk about weight all the time. Like that's their focus. Yeah.
Everyone is a little disordered.
Yeah.
A lot
right.
And this is public consumption and normalized by people who have millions of followers on the internet and are made of money and have TV shows all about the fact that they in fact exist on the planet
and
with money.
Yeah. Yeah.
The impact of the kind of quote influencer, and I'm not talking about social media per se, mm-hmm. but like a Kardashian is an influencer and that's
absolutely.
A person with a lot of power for like a totally different demographic than Gwyneth Paltrow. She's targeting different people, but that doesn't mean that Goop stuff doesn't still appeal to young folks and like crystals and all
totally.
Whatever.
The natural appeal, like that kind of, you know, back to nature. Come on.
Right. It's like, I'm not getting Botox, but name it something else. It's still botulinum toxin in my face somewhere. No judgment. If anybody's choosing that, that's
no,
okay.
No, totally.
Just call it Botox.
But she goes a step further to really, I mean, this is Gwyneth we're talking about, to really shame others' choices. I mean, that's the thing. You're not presenting a neutral perspective or opinion. You're really saying, if you get Botox, that's gross and unnatural, but this thing that I'm being paid to promote and put in my face is not.
Also still botulinum.
Yeah.
It's still what it is.
Right.
That's fine.
You know, what's interesting. I think it was last year. I was scrolling through TikTok and I do love TikTok. I got to say, as a person, it's my favorite platform because I am so deeply kind of just enthralled or connected. Like I can't even explain it. I've never found it on any other app where it's just, the algorithm's great. Just shows you things that I truly love. Like I see dogs. I see, you know, just people being cute, just nice things in the world. It's such a nice break, to be honest. That's my TikTok feed anyway. But I did come across, as someone who was born in the 80s, 90s films are, you know, just cult films to me. And I came across a superstar of the 90s, Alicia Silverstone. And I know she's kind of resurfaced, you know, in a Netflix series. Oh, I'm dying to tell me what you think. Oh, you don't know. A Babysitter's Club, the amazing books of my youth. They have a Netflix show. And she's a mom on it. So like, yeah, I know. I was like, I feel like we're a similar age. Wow. Okay. So I see her face and I was excited. I love Alicia. Well, I loved Clueless, let's be clear. So I had this nostalgic kickback, right? She was responding to a comment about, you know, tell me your secrets of youth, essentially, right? Someone was asking her. Now, I'm not really that interested, but I was definitely intrigued as to what, I guess, how she would frame this and what her response might be. So to be clear, because I actually went back and before our chat reminded myself what she said. She said it's because she eats a plant-based diet. And she like was very clear about the verb here. She cut out sugar. And so I decided to stitch the video, and I kind of added on that this is really unexamined privilege that's very dangerous. If nothing, like, forget the youth bit. Forget that you don't acknowledge your genetics, your wealth, Botox, whatever. And you don't have to. Like, you don't owe that explanation to anybody. But the fact that you have then gone on to shame others' choices, which is exactly what she did in the video. What was interesting about this was people did not like me.
But,
like, how dare you attack Alicia? She's just helping people.
She cares so much about you, Nadia.
So much.
She has seen that stitch and she's like, oh my God, who is this practitioner in Australia?
It's wild. I mean, look, lucky I don't care. But wow, I was so it's this other layer of I have to protect the industry, like, as an individual, because if she is attacked, then I'm attacked, I guess, is maybe how folks see it. Like, maybe coming back to, like, that individualism, maybe I can't control all these things. Maybe what I eat isn't actually every single reason that something is happening or not in my life. So I get that that's why people find it confronting and challenging when you talk about this. But again, it kind of misses the mark on the fact that it's just so tedious with the celebrity, I guess.
It is so tedious. And it's tedious with celebrity, and I think probably equally as dangerous when somebody has followers anywhere.
Mm-hmm,
You don't have to be a super wealthy Kim Kardashian, Gwyneth Paltrow to have influence, right? Everyone who has interaction with anyone else on the planet has influence. And so talking about diet culture stuff, it falls out of people's mouths in a way that it's like you can't control.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there isn't a lot of social etiquette around how it's just like, blah, 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 blah. Like, naturally, this is what we talk about. And so, I mean, I think there are just layers and layers and layers of why this is so challenging. And that is just one of them.
So well said. Anna, before we say goodbye to each other today, I would love for you to share, for anyone who cannot see, Anna is wearing this divine red, I believe it's a jumper, and it has the trademarked word earth suit. Well, I know it to be a trademark, and I wonder if you could describe that and kind of share what that's about, because I love it.
Sure. So I trademarked the word because I'm going to use it. The plan was to have programs to sell on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm right now just a private practice practitioner, and I would love to be able to a little bit more of myself elsewhere in, you know, times when I'm not actually working. So maybe that's a 2022 something. But I use the expression or the word earth suit synonymously kind of with body. And I think that there is, like, really when we think about it, this is what we are in, right? We have this one body, this one, some people have written, I call it a flesh sack.
Oh.
I do not, but
that's very
it's more glamorous than that. Ooh,
yeah. No, earth suit is beautiful. Like, it's beautiful.
This is what we get. This is what we get. And so if we spent a fraction of the time that we do trying to modify our body experiences, trying to change our bodies while we are on this planet, if we were to instead, and this obviously comes with privilege and practice and therapy and time. But our, you know, the point of being here is not the body. And we get one earth suit, and we can choose how we want to interact with it. And again, there are layers of privilege to that statement. Absolutely. Itself. But I don't know. I think there's something, I like it. I think there's something, like there's a little bit of distance between body and earth suit, although they are synonyms. But the concept of an earth suit to me is much more expansive, and it doesn't have an age. It's just like, it doesn't have an age. It doesn't have
a gender identity. Yeah. It's just
right.
Yeah.
It has, we get one, one. And so we can be kind to it or not, and it will still be the singular earth suit experience that we get.
For me, what it brings up when you, when hearing you speak about it, I'm so grateful that you can, is it's very healing language like that. Well, that's how it feels for me, is that term. I really connect with that idea that you've offered of a bit of distance. Maybe that distance is from the really just such heavy ideas. As you said, living in a body in the world is tough. And of course, depending on your identity, even tougher. So the idea that there is maybe another frame to look at it, another, or experience it. So thanks for coming up with it and for being here. I loved it.
I loved it too.
I might have to get you back for another episode.
Love it. Same time, another day.
So as Anna and I both speak to in this exploration with such deep compassion, wanting food to cure is so damn understandable. And thinking that it might, and just hanging in there, it's so valid. And so is feeling really disillusioned, disempowered, and angry, and whatever else you feel when it doesn't work, like both Anna and I have experienced. I feel confident speaking on behalf of Anna, you know, right here now as well, in saying that if a change to how you eat feels, one, like your call, wow, that's a big storm. Can you hear that? So let me repeat it. If you feel like a change to how you eat, number one, feels like your call, and number two, has made you feel better, that's super cool and we are super happy for you. But that isn't the same as a cure. That isn't evidence for other people to draw from or be suggested to. Remember, please don't offer this to people, even if you think it's helpful, because it's not. And it's certainly not helpful when people in a position like myself or like Anna use that as evidence for their clients. Both Anna and I live with chronic illness that cannot be cured. And at times, I'm just speaking for myself here, it fucking sucks. It's also not my fault. Not the getting of the illnesses in my case, or how severe their symptoms are at any one time. I cannot eat my way into it or out of it, and no celery juice is going to turn that ship around. So when you see things like, this healed me, this healed my gut, what is this voice I'm doing? You know, if you can't pronounce it, don't eat it. Our ancestors wouldn't have. Superfood and inflammatory and low toxin, real food. If you see that stuff, I really hope that you can consider this language and the products that are no doubt related to them in a different and more helpful light. That's the point of this episode, to give you back some true empowerment and body autonomy. For all of the links and notes from today's exploration of the problem with wellness culture, including how to find Anna in her earth suit, head to my website, nadiafelsch.com/podcast. Alternatively, you'll find the link in your podcast player. Thank you so much for joining me. See you next time.